Okay, there we have it. All right, tonight is our second class in the Senior Fellowship. The title is, Did Martin Luther King and Avram Share the Same Dream? So we are going to, this might be our second time, for those who are my senior fellows, veterans, we actually utilized just a little, analyzed a couple years ago, the Martin Luther King dream as a sort of introduction to Moshe Rabbeinu. And we had a different angle. Just by way of introduction, those we're going to share a portion of the Martin Luther King famous "I Had a Dream" speech, which, according to many, could be the most impactful or best piece of oratory in the 20th century. So, if you do not avail yourself to watch the entire speech, I recommend, I'm not going to watch all 17 minutes tonight, just the portions pertinent to us. And there's a lot of lessons. In a couple years ago, we analyzed all the various biblical allusions that he had in his speech. We're not going to talk about it tonight, but it is a masterclass, a master speech, and you can make many and learn many things, not to mention the art of public speaking. There are many classes you can have just from that one speech. We've already had one, this will be our second. What we care about is introduction to appreciate Avram on a deeper and, as we always do, contemporary level. That's our mission, that's what we're up to. So without further ado, let the shiur begin with Martin Luther King. You can't beat that. So I'm going to shift three. Switch the okay, here we go. Starting up. Yes.
Hey, Rabbi Penny, could you put on the closed captioning? Because it's hard to hear, but maybe.
Let me not do that because I don't want to obscure him because I just opened the volume much harder. Let's do a second chance. If it is, tell me 1 second on the play. Tell me if you hear this.
No.
Okay. Where did it go? That would be great. Bear with me a second. We're going to have a little bit of
So even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live up true meaning of its creed. We hold to be self-evident that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the people in justice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream. My poor little children one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Yes, that's the standing part. Contact other character. Okay, well, let's get into it here. We'll share screen. All right, here we go. All right, so I have on this on your sheet here the relevant point. So simply put, who can summarize in your own understanding, what was MLK's dream? You see, I use the word I have a dream a dozen times. What is his essential dream?
Equality.
Equality. All people are equal. Well, he's saying that we're talking about it. He says all men are, the Constitution says all men are created equal.
And that the injustices around the South and the world, that people will be treated equally in eyes.
All right, so not that the people are equal, but that they should be treated equal. People have made the claim that the United States has been you're going to hear this, the United States of America has been a democratic country for precisely 50 years. Have you heard that claim? Why? Because until civil rights, if you were a black person, you were not treated equally. You were discriminated against, and in the South, rather viciously. Okay, so that claim is that for 200 years or a little less than 200 years, America claimed to be a democratic country, but only the last 50 years is it or approaching a democratic country. Okay, so. And what fundamentally, he makes a powerful argument, but not using an argument like a lawyer. He's not speaking as a lawyer. He's speaking in a certain sense more like a preacher. What's his argument against the racist policies of America, specifically against Afro-American, the Black American community, or all people of color? What's his argument? He makes a very strong argument. And in front of you, I've quoted you the text. Look at the text for a moment. What he makes an argument. He makes a Talmudic argument, if I may add, of what's his argument. Yes. Right. So what's his argument? So what's his kasha? What's his point? Right, they are either hypocritical, or they are or lying. Or the point is that, as he says, I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. Implication being that currently it is not. It has these nice aspirations, nice Hallmark card posters about what you think about humanity, but in reality, in the gritty reality, you don't really think that. You really say, we hold this truth that are self-evident that all white men are created equal. White men. The white and the men. Okay, that's what you really hold. You claim. So he says, you know, so therefore, put up or shut up. Either be honest, change the Constitution to what you really are acting as, or change your behavior to be aligned with the Constitution. But you can't, he's basically calling them out on their implicit hypocrisy, their implicit lie, their implicit untruth. Okay? So therefore, every American venerates the Declaration of Independence. Nobody's against, that's the founding document. Everybody agrees about that, but yet you're not living up to it. You are saying one thing and doing another. That's his basic argument. Okay? And his proof text. Now notice, somebody read from Zoom land, so there, because everybody can hear you, but people out except for me, they can't hear. So Brooke, but read page 2, read from the Declaration. Very interesting.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Excellent. So this, from our, now all of our founding fathers of the United States of America, nearly all of them knew either the Bible by heart or close to it, because that was the definition of a literate person, a man or even woman of culture in 1776. You knew the King James Bible cover to cover essentially by heart. Okay, there was no Netflix. You read the Bible. Okay, and you know, some are more religious, some are less, like Benjamin Franklin, who was a deist, not religious, but he also knew the Bible also. What are they implicitly referencing? What part of the Chumash are they principally referencing in this opening statement? Exactly. Right. In other words, since all mankind was created with a special godliness, Tzelem Elohim, so therefore, since that flows from that unalienable rights, so since we're all the same, we have all the same rights. That is in the first chapter. Vayivra Elohim et Adam b'Tzelemo. And that's talking about the divine, literally the image of God. Now, God, of course, is not physical, so he doesn't have a reflection, which means that in some sense, he has a feature he shares a feature of Hashem, which are fundamentally, as described by the Rishonim, such as the Rambam, basically means a mind, an intelligence, a wisdom, the capacity to express their free will, their capacity to be a creator. They're all emerging from that that non-physical source of human dignity, human soul. Okay? They describe it in different terms based upon their worldview. That was the position of our founding fathers. And therefore, since everybody has a Tzelem Elohim, they have the same rights. Because they're not fundamental. Because in essence, forget about the external packaging called the human body. Their essence is what? The same. Yes. Us. So Chloe, I'm gonna repeat your question because they can't hear you. Chloe asked a outstanding question, which is probably a class in its own right, which is, Rabbi, you're talking a good game over here. But lo and behold, the Torah obviously sanctions slavery because it has laws about how one treats your slave. And only that has two kinds of slave. You got your Jewish slave and you got your non-Jewish slave, and they don't have the same rights and benefits, right?
Yelon Amalek.
And I'm Amalek, thank you. So, right, correct. So these are excellent questions, which really are, we've actually, over the years we've discussed, but Can I give a 25-cent answer to address the question? But I want to say up front, it's worthy of further exploration. No, I don't want to do it because it's too complex. Just if you are dying to know the answer, go on to YU Torah. I have a class, which we did, some of you in the audience here, should the state of Israel reinstate the law of the Jewish slave? Okay, we discussed that. So that's the hour-long presentation of that one question. As far as the Kohen and the Levi and the different roles and responsibilities, in a company, you have the CEO, you have the CFO, you have the manager, you have people who have different roles and responsibilities. You're not saying, now one might be treated better, but truthfully, from this doctrine of Tzelem Elokim, you should treat the person who is the janitor and the CEO equally based on their human dignity. Now, this person might have a more critical role for the success of the company. That's a separate point. But as far as human dignity, and that is the halacha, you have to treat every person, Jew and non-Jew, as we mentioned last, the Talmud Chacham treats everybody b'sever panim yafot, with a nice, warm countenance, face. Exactly.
So CEO isn't hereditary.
What?
CEO isn't hereditary.
So Max raised another question. Oh, so then how could you have, why having a dynastic dimension to that? Why is it not meritocracy? Done in an issue of meritocracy. Good question. That's another, again, that's worthy of a class itself, and hopefully this coming year we will we'll tackle that. Okay. Just as you know, yesterday, Shana, after 4 years or 5 years of senior fellowship, she's now only doing she's doing the Parsha class, but she asked if we can do a special class on Kohelet, which is a book of Ecclesiastes, the book of from King Solomon, a very difficult book. And Rabbi Sachs, and I prepared it. He delivered it yesterday. So I do take recommendations. I try to get to everything. So stay tuned. Text me, message me. We'll do that. And not to mention, if it's something that you think has universal interest, you can put it onto the Halacha chat. And I'll answer it. I'll do that as well. I've done that as well. Okay, so good question. Hold those questions. Let's keep on going. So now I want to address Judaism's orientation toward racism. And if you only pay attention to this one thing, I will call tonight a success, because this is very critical. How does the principle of Tzelem Elokim forbid being racist? What is, in ours, yeah, somebody asked you a question. Where does it say in the Torah you can't be a racist? It does not say openly in those words. Anna? Why not? Let's go deeper. Why not? Why? And what is the doctrine of racism really saying? Yes, but why? Why is that person lesser?
If you not have a certain quality or characteristic or something, that's something.
A certain quality and characteristic from what, Amanda? So
they lack.
So, but race, the doctrine of racism, it is a materialistic perspective. I'm treating this person as a lesser because they have black skin, or they're Asian, or fill in the blank. And I'm saying not only them, but all people who have this external packaging, something of their physicality, whatever it may be. Short people, tall, whatever it is, you're saying because they have this physical feature, and we identify it as a negative, you're saying which essentially you're assessing people essentially by their, you're saying, what is their essence? Their body. What did the first chapter of Genesis says? The essence of all people is the non-physical component, their soul, their tzelem elokim. So you're really, he was essentially material because he always talked about the Jew, always used a phrase, we talked about this in other senior fellows class, about the Jewish blood. He always talked about that we don't want their Jewish blood to mix with the idealized Aryan blood. What's up with the blood? Because they took it as a materialistic phenomenon, that there was something absolutely superior in the Aryan blood, and there's something criminal and disease based of the Jewish blood, and that's why they have all the rules of intermarriage. They felt that literally that the Jew is tainting the pure, that's why they use the term, the pure Aryan race. They had a physical perspective of being a physical excellence. So racist, by the way, so therefore a person's a racist, essentially they are a materialist. They're saying all you are is a body, and therefore, and certain bodies are ideal, white men. Anything else is lesser.
Miriam got struck with Cyrus after referring to Sephora as a Cushite too.
It was not because of that. They think that as a fact, that she was a Cushite. Which, all right, so that's another question. But she spoke some sort of Lashon Hara. It's not overt in the text. We have it. If you want to know about that, we covered that too. So we've covered all the hot topics over the last, again, by the way, what's today? Today is, what day of the month is it? 13th. In 3 days, I will be at MJE for 15 years. 15 years, yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. But my point being, in addition to that accomplishment, which it is, I think we have covered, so of the classes, I probably have 900 classes, most of them are at MJE. So we have covered among those classes a lot of these topics. So, and they all, classes came from questions that students, either you yourselves or your colleagues have asked. So that's the deal. So to put it succinctly, Judaism, to be a Jewish racist is to deny the prime principle that mankind is endowed with a unique and godly like soul, and also is to fundamentally be a materialist and say all there is really is matter, and there's better matter, there's better material bodies, and there are inferior material bodies. Okay, so that is the issue. So we are going to take this week's parsha, as Rabbi Avi pointed out, is Parshas Lech Lecha. We are going to take a look at a very strange episode in the first chapter of the parsha, where Avram is told, as Rabbi Heller said, "Go to land I'll show you," which was Canaan. He shows up, and what is Avram greeted with? What is Avram greeted with when he shows up to Canaan? This is Chumash 101, guys. You're senior fellows. You need to know these answers. Come on. What is he? A famine. Correct, Amanda. Well done. Exactly. All right. So for the benefit of everybody here, let's have somebody. Matt, can you read? From Avram's Troubles.
It's very tiny on Zoom. I've got it. Avram's Troubles. There was a famine in the land.
Hold on. I'm going to change. Hold on one second. I'm going to change you to the. Well, here we go. Try it again.
There was a famine in the land. Avram headed south to Egypt to stay there for a while, since the famine had grown very severe in the land. As they approached Egypt, he said to his wife, Sarah, "Behold, now I know you are a good-looking woman." You are a good-looking gal. "When the Egyptians see you, they will assume that you are my wife and kill me, allowing you to live. Oh, that was a thing on my screen. Allowing you to live. If you would say that you are my sister, then they will then be good to me for your sake, and through your efforts, my life be spared. When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that his wife was very beautiful. Pharaoh's officials saw her and spoke highly of her to Pharaoh. The woman was taken to Pharaoh's palace. He treated Avram well because of her and thus acquired sheep, cattle, donkeys, male and female slaves, she donkeys and camels. God struck Pharaoh and his palace with severe plagues because of Avram's wife. Sarai? What do you say Sarai. Without the H?
No, Sarai.
Sarai.
Her initial name was Sarai, nor they were Avram without the H, Avraham, and she is Sarai. They go with name change in chapter 17. Okay, that's in five chapters. Anyway, so let me just succinctly share the story. So here it is. Avram shows up to Canaan, and there is a famine. He and his whole entourage essentially are now in a desperate situation. So what do you think that most people would do? That's you know, most people, I believe, as Anna points out, would basically turn around. You know, very nice this report, this mitzvah to show up to Canaan. This is terrible. You made a promise. I'm going to be a great and mighty nation. I'm not going to be great and mighty nation if I'm dead. There'll be no nation if I am in fact dead. So interestingly, Avram, of course, does not stay there, does not, rely upon a miracle. Well, I'll just stay here, and Hashem will magically provide food for me. He does not make that claim. Rather, he goes down to Egypt. Why is he going down to Egypt? What is unique about Egypt? I know a little bit about why. What's Egyptian food? Because
the Nile Delta.
They do not. Yes. This, okay. Seventh grade, everybody. Okay, world history, seventh grade. Because of the Nile overflows its banks. Yearly, therefore irrigating and providing irrigation for their crops. And therefore, if it does not rain in Egypt, they will have food, period. That's why Avram went down there, okay? Because he's got to eat. And he basically makes the argument of essentially a argument of we call mitzvah of living with them. You know, the mitzvah is v'chai b'hem, to live through the mitzvahs and not die through the mitzvahs, which basically means like this. Which is that he made the following argument. God asked me to come to the land of Israel. That's my mitzvah. Okay. If I do this mitzvah and I'm dead, then there's no point to this mitzvah, because he intuited that the purpose of mitzvah is to improve the quality of life. There is no improvement of the quality of life if I'm in fact dead. Therefore, I have to take the initiative and go down to Egypt. Then he shows up to the Egyptian border. Then as Max chuckled and intuited a problem in the biblical text, in the Chumash over here. Behold, now I know that you are a good-looking woman. So Avram and Sarai are not newlyweds. Even if they're newlyweds, that's bizarre. They've been married for some time. So what is he wearing? What is she wearing? A burqa 24/7? So we're going to go to Rashi. We're going to go down to Rashi. Max, I'm not done with you, Max. Read out the Rashi.
Still here.
Good.
All right. A little Rashi goodness.
A little Rashi action.
The Midrashic explanation is, until now, he had not perceived her beauty owing to the extreme modesty of both. This is where you get comments about, like, clothes with holes on hanging out to dry. The Midrash's explanation is
not to free associate. Like, what is this? How does this make you feel, Max? But I appreciate the joke. Okay, keep on going. Let's get the text. Let's get it out there.
The Midrashic explanation is, until now, he had not perceived her beauty owing to the extreme modesty of both of them. Now, however, through this event, he became cognizant of it. Still, the real sense of the text is this. Behold,
Rashi is first giving what they call the Midrash, which is sort of the story behind the story. It's a rabbinic understanding, okay? And then they call the plain shot. The plain shot is the immediate sense of the verse, okay? Which is what?
Behold, now the time has come when I am anxious because of your beauty. I have long known that you are beautiful, but now we are traveling among people. Have never been accustomed to seeing such a beautiful woman. A similar example from later in Genesis. Behold now, my lords, turn aside, I pray you.
Okay, so basically, Quantum Shot is means that he didn't say, now I know, or now I need to deal with the situation. Okay? So let's just break it down logically. Avram showing up. They have to provide food for his extended entourage. Okay. How is Sarai's beauty a liability? Correct. So basically, if they go on as proudly as husband and wife, apparently they will not they will not do the act of adultery. They don't have a problem with the adultery thing. They have a problem with adultery, but they got no problem with murder. They will make her single. And little Avram will get cement shoes and find himself in the bottom of the Nile, right? Okay, and now Sarai will be available. Okay, well, worse. Yeah, hold on one second. Now, so therefore, what's his solution? What's his solution? Let's get the facts first. Chloe, what's Avram's solution? Okay, fine. So you'll get back. I will not forget about you. Okay, so what's the solution is? Well, come on, factually. His sister. So therefore, if they ignore her, great. If they take her, they won't, because she basically, he's saying, she's going to be a sex slave anyways. She's going to find herself in, no, that's what it is. So the question is, what's his alternative? He's assuming if we stay in Canaan and there's a famine, we're going to die. Have you seen those pictures of famines in Egypt, in Africa, in our day and age? Ugly scene. There's no there's no restaurants. You know what I mean? There's like, so if it's, I'm not saying this. I know I want, most people will read this seven or eight verses and they'll just go like not understand the significance here. You understand what he's dealing with here. If we stay in Canaan, we're all dead. If I go to Mitzrayim, we're going to live. But there's a cost. The cost is, if we go as husband and wife, I will now become a marked man. I will largely have a strong chance I will be killed because they will not sleep with a married woman. She will become single-eyed, as they say. And then she will be taken to the harem. Oh, so the best of the bad situation, first choice, all dead. Second choice, me dead, and she is a sex slave. The third choice is, I'm alive, we're all alive, and she happens to be now a sex slave to Paro. Right? Those are the three choices. That's what's going through Avram's head. And now he says, Nayadati ki yishiyapas. In other words, I recognize that your beauty, and Thomas says she's one of the most beautiful women of history. She's amazing. And it's going to be a problem. Now we have Chloe, who's dying to ask the question. Dead. No, you die. You die means I know. That would be like a rabbinic sermon kind of interpretation of that. The word yoda means to know. Yeah, that means I know. That's it. I know. I figured this out. I got a problem. And those, and from the, on the pshat level, there's three level. There's three options. Y'all die. I die. Y'all live. She's in Paro's harem. Terrible choices. Now, why is he not chivalrous? Why does he take on the Egyptian empire? What? Ah. That's a good question. That's a good question. All right, so we have two good questions here. Hold on, wait, 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 wait Ilya asked a very good question. He says, so if, Rabbi, you tell me those are the three options, let him go back to Mesopotamia. So it's interesting. Okay, was it, so that is not open in the text. That's from the Midrash. So if you take the Midrashic narrative, he left Ur and Haran, not because he was because he decided to leave. He left because he was a fugitive of the state, because he was convincing people that idolatry is a false illusion, and it angered the leadership, Nimrod, according to Midrash, and he had to escape for his life. Therefore, according to the Midrash, there was no escape door. But according to the Pshat, that's an excellent kasha. I want to think about that. I don't want to give a, I don't have a quick answer to it, so I want to get that. And then Adrian asked the kasha like this. Hold on. What about Sarah? If she's now brought in, because she is acting like a single woman, but can a married woman knowingly, willingly sleep with anybody? No, it's adultery. It's one of the three big ones. Right, you gotta die. Now you could say, Archie, I can get out on a technicality, the Torah is not given yet, so that's not a law. That would be my lawyer instinct, get out of that way. Well, it's not halacha yet, because there is no halacha, technical, except for the seventh B'nai Noach. So you could do that. Then you can also ask the same kasha to, what about Esther? According to the Midrash, Esther's married to Mordechai. And the Talmud has a lengthy conversation. How can she, in fact, be sleeping with Achashverosh? She's having adultery every single time. The one answer is Esther Karka Olami. She was completely passive. All right, I'll let you dwell upon that. Or she's not an active participant. Okay, so how that, well, she brings its own problems, like is he gonna really buy that? Okay, the plain shot, she's a single woman, it doesn't problem. But the reason why I'm entertaining all these questions is because we learn together 1 hour a week. I don't know if you just noticed, right now we're at minute, you know, we started a little late, but we, at 8:50, we've already raised a short amount of time, outstanding questions that each could have, if we would, you know, asked, we could have more conversations, more classes from. I'm just saying, we're just literally, the way that good Torah is, you open up the box and then you pull something out and then it pulls something else out and pull something else out. And I can't answer all these questions. That's a good kasha about Sarai. As you know, the end of the story is that, what we just read, that before Paro goes to approach her, somehow there's divine intervention. He becomes violently sick, and somehow he's no longer interested in a sexual encounter. Okay, that's what Hashem does. Okay, the plagues. Okay, now, but I want to do the Midrash, the one that Max couldn't even read initially with a straight face, even though he still didn't have his camera on. Like, I felt it. So question 7, according to the Midrash, until now he had not perceived her beauty owing to the extreme modesty of both of them. How is it possible for a married man not to notice his wife's beauty for decades of married life? Did Sarah wear a burqa 24/7? And if so, how did Avram become aware of her beauty now? If he's absolutely unaware of her beauty, like a blind guy, right? Then how come suddenly now shows up to the Egyptian border, ba-dum, now he knows. Yeah, you want to give it a shot?
So fixated on the internal, like for example, when after the pretty well and she gets cake and all that stuff. I mean, that happened afterwards, but you know what I mean? Like, they had a relationship that was based on chesed and this idea of the internal connection. I mean, it's great that Abraham is able to do that. I don't think most guys would be able to.
Okay,
Abraham's sadi, so perhaps this is true.
Okay, right. So, excellent series of observations on all those points. So, I'm going to go to we're doing a double video class tonight, because I like sometimes double video situation, double header. So I'm going to introduce this. Professor Richard Feynman was, I think, a Nobel Prize winning physicist. And it's going to be a short minute and a half video where he's always having an argument with one of his artist friends. Of who can appreciate the beauty of a flower more, the artist or the scientist? Okay, the artist or the scientist. So before I even go on that, who do you think can appreciate the beauty of a rose? the artist of the science. So raise your hand if you can think the artist will appreciate the beauty of a rose more than the scientist. Who thinks the scientist? Okay, why? Okay. So you guys. Okay, so we have a smart group of people here tonight. Okay, so let's go to the videotape. Okay.
I have a friend.
Okay, hold on. I'm gonna go to the video. Share screen, guys. Don't worry. I'm not discriminating against people who are not here physically. Where is? Go. Yeah, this. It's like a 50 steps. And then I got to change it to this thing. Okay, here we go. Boom.
You hold up a flower and say, look how beautiful it is. And I agree. And he says, you see, as I even ask, see how beautiful it is. But you as a scientist, oh, take this all apart and it becomes dull thing. And I think it's kind of nutty. First of all, the beauty that he sees is available to other people and to me too, I believe, although I may not be quite as refined as aesthetically as he is, that I can appreciate the beauty of the flower. At the same time, I see much more about the flower than he sees. I could imagine cells, the complicated actions, which also have a beauty. I mean, it's not just beauty at this dimension of 1 centimeter. There's also beauty at a smaller dimension, the inner structure, also the processes, the fact that the colors and the flower evolved in order to attract insects to pollinate it is interesting. It means that insects can see the color. It adds a question. Does this aesthetic sense also exist in the lower forms? Does it? Why is it aesthetic? All kinds of interesting questions, which the science knowledge only adds to the excitement, the mystery, and the awe of a flower. It only adds. I don't understand how it's suppressed.
Okay. From Far Rockaway. Okay. All right, so let's go to, all right. Question time. Here we go. Why do you think artists think that scientific outlook screens people like Richard Feynman from access to the aesthetic experience of life? For example, losing out on the beauty of a flower. Why do people believe that? Okay. Well, first of all, is science only functional? He's a theoretical physicist. He's not building a bridge. Well, there's engineering, the pragmatic, and there's a theoretical.
But generally, science to understand the world.
Okay. So it's functional, utilitarian. Okay. Okay. Correct, but the question is, why is the artist telling Richard Feynman, you're losing out on the aesthetic experience, on the experience of true beauty, you're losing it all out?
Because of the reductionist of materialism, that the scientist reduces it to its part and doesn't sort of see the integrated whole or the aesthetic experience of it.
So you're saying that since he's going to break it down to various processes, components, he's going to lose that aesthetic thing. But Richard says, no, I see the immediate level of beauty, but I see a lot more. So that he's arguing, he's pushing back. So you're right. So Max, who is an artist, is saying that by deconstructing the flower into all its various parts, you're gonna destroy the aesthetic beauty because you are now reducing it basically down to equations. and to photosynthesis and to cell structure and all the different elements that you guys learned in university, right? Biology, okay? Okay, so let's amplify Feynman. How does Feynman use the example of a flower to explain how his scientific outlook actually amplifies and enhances his aesthetic experience? He's arguing, I'm way more appreciating the flower than any artist is. He's saying you're completely wrong. Jamie? He says, I see the flower, its colors, the fact that it can attract insects, which now brings a whole question. It becomes like a little small universe of beauty, and we, to translate into religious terms, I'm going to label what he's saying. I'm able to see the Chachmas Hashem, the wisdom of God, implicit in beautiful flower. He's saying, I can see the godly wisdom in that flower. The artist can only see the beauty of the flower. So I see the beauty, but I see the depth and the sort of like near infinite dimensions of that beauty. So he's arguing, my experience is qualitatively deeper and superior to the artist. We're seeing the same thing, but we're not seeing the same thing. So therefore, in the eyes of Avram, how was Sarah like a Feynman-esque flower? What did Avram saw her, but what did he see? In other words, there are two people that looked at Sarah. There was the member of Paro's staff that looked at Sarah. What a hot girl, woman. Lady, whatever the Egyptian is, whatever that is in Egyptian, okay? In Near Eastern Egyptian, right? Avram sees her. What does he perceive in her? He perceives her essence. He perceives her Tzelem Elohim. He recognizes this woman is an amazing person. She is a deep thinker. She is compassionate. She is his life partner in bringing a revolution to humanity, which to this very day, we are the beneficiaries 4,000 years later. Thank you, Sarah. So he saw her beauty, but he saw so much more what the Midrash is really saying, that became, in a certain sense, in the background. The just like Feynman sees all of the scientific processes in the flower, The precise hue of the redness of the rose is not essentially his focus. In his relating to a woman of gigantic stature, of a great soul such as Sarah, he knew that other. That's why that answers the question. It's not that he didn't see her. Not like he was walking around with black with a blinders on. He saw her, but he saw her in a profoundly different way. And therefore, in a certain sense, that was not really a significant. But now he recognized that I'm going into a very hedonistic, over-sexualized society. And now I have to look at my situation here, and I have to look at my wife in a different sense. Houston, there's a problem. He's got a problem now. Right. But in other words, I know how others will now look at you, or I'm now going to pay attention to that. So the Midrash is saying, really, it's not saying that he did not know intellectually that people would look at Amanda pointed out, how the average guy will look at Sarah. The average guy is going to be lost, like, look at the external beauty. He's perceiving her qualitatively different. He's operating a different framework. That's how the Midrash, that's a good example of Midrash. The Midrash is always giving, the plain shot is, now I know you're beautiful and therefore I have to deal with the problem. That's the plain level. Now I know means I didn't fool, I'm not living in that world. I'm not living in sort of like the Hugh Hefner perspective on women, that I look at women essentially as their physical dimension. He relating to her qualitatively different. But now you recognize that he's entering to that different realm. He now has to shift gears. So that's why he didn't, not that he didn't know factually, not relating to her in that well. It's in the same way that you have Feynman and his friend, the artist, looking at the flower. They're seeing the same flower. In a certain sense, they're not seeing the same flower. Okay? Now, let's bring it home. 11. Holiness, Kedusha, is acting in a manner that emphasizes and strengthens the reality that the soul, not the body, is our essential part. Kedusha is holiness. How did Avram apply Kedusha's idea of emphasizing our soul and de-emphasizing the body be applied in his awareness of Sarah's beauty? How is the perspective really expressing Kedusha? Yes. Right. Yes. Correct. So his relationship to her, would you say that he related to her with Kedusha? He related to her essentially as a mind, as a soul, as a metaphysical being who happens to have a body. Now I'm going to go into Egypt. We're going to the anti-Kedusha zone. I got to deal with a problem here. Okay. Now, let me now make that practical even more. Scenario number one, Jane M. Geer steps out of her Midtown office for lunch. Okay. She passes an Italian pizzeria. The smell is so inviting. She is tired and she has to be on an important call in 25 minutes. The kosher restaurant is 9 minutes away. What is her Kedusha struggle? What should she do if she wants to make her soul primary? What would she do if she wants to make her body primary? That's a Kedusha struggle right there. Boom. Scott. Why? 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 I'm going to be a little annoying. Right, and presumably for a good reason. Okay, so I'm trying to operate based upon a principle of a certain principled life of discipline. Which discipline am I in the Torah's outlook of discipline eating? And therefore to be mindful, I have to walk past the pizzeria. But if I only want to satisfy my body, what am I doing? I'm going to that pizzeria and I'm getting whatever I want. Definitely a definite situation for a double sausage situation, okay? So that's it, that's a Kedusha struggle. Am I making this my soul primary or making my body primer? You could call it, in a certain sense, Kedusha is soul food. Soul food. You know what I'm saying? In a sense, not that I'm making me, it's because it's a food that my soul selected. Think about that. Okay. Scenario two. Joe MG here.
Wait, can we go back to that one for a sec?
Yes,
so on one hand, I understand your point about, okay, he didn't emphasize her beauty and his mentality, but in essence, he basically chose his own physical survival over potentially other problematic choices. I mean, in lying about, you know, their relationship and putting her into Pharaoh's harem.
Right. So he made the fun thing that it is better for her to presumably become a sex slave to Pharaoh than he be killed. That's a decision.
Is that really a Kedusha decision?
So that's all right. So, but say it again. What should he have done? What should he have done? Do you have to know if she should not have sex with this guy because he should die?
So, I mean, if you look at most of modern Jewish history, were you supposed to forsake your Judaism because you were being frightened? Right, isn't that the whole concept of dying al kedusha shem?
If only for the big three. Only if they're forcing you to do idolatry, if they're doing a murder, or to do adultery. So that was, so Adrian's question is.
That was Adrian's question, yeah.
Adrian's question, I said, so it's a good question. We mentioned that. That's a good topic. That's class. That question is class worthy in its own right. So I'm gonna put that on the side. I just wanna drill down on the concept of the producer here. I wanna get down our scenario two. Joe, MG, you're schmoozing with buddy Bill. Bill made racist comment about those damn Asians. How does the principle of Kedusha demand that Joe confront Bill about his race attitude and comments? In what way does racism emphasize the body of humankind over the soul of humankind? In other words, we all hear people, I think all of us at some point have heard somebody utter racist comments. And the question is, what are you going to do? Are you going to be quiet? Well, obviously, if they have a gun to your head, obviously, you know. But I'm just saying, does Judaism support being racist in a joking manner? All right. So the point is, if you are, all right, so let's see. In every way, whatever you say has to be with wisdom. But if a person is stepping up to confront racism, they are fulfilling the principle of Kedusha of saying that, no, we do not judge people by their externalities. We judge them by their soul. And this person is a good person, or these people are no different than everybody else. So the Torah is a demand. You should not be quiet. I'm not saying you have to lose your life, but you should not be quiet to racism. Because really is that if you embrace the reality of a soul, that man is different, qualitatively different, and do not reduce people to being physical entities, then you have to. Then you cannot countenance racism. In every situation, I'm just saying that has to be your mandate. So the bottom line is just to laugh it off and ignore it is wrong. And if you have influence, you should say something. You should. All right. So you have to be. Look, that goes to the general issue. How does one deal with the issue of how do you deal with the issue of correcting people who are acting improperly or wrong? You have to, sometimes you know that the person is, whatever you're going to say is going to make no impact. Okay, so you have that. So the general principle is the wise person does not say anything that will not be heard. Okay? But you have to be really honest. But maybe Bill knows you for 15 years and you have your relationship, you have influence. You just don't want to make the relationship uncomfortable. You don't want to tell him anything. That's wrong. You have to be able to say, Bill, well, I love you. I want you to be this guy for here. Maybe you got poor education. Let me share with you why, tell you why I feel that's, you know, from my perspective, why that's should not be said for the following reasons. And yes, it's going to be uncomfortable, but you have an obligation now, obviously, if you think it is, you have zero chance of success, then you just walk away. But if people have influence, if you have a friendship, you say, you know, Bill, you're way, dude, you're way off base. And let me share with you, not because, and I want to say, I want to make very clear, and this going back to a little bit, Adrian was alluding to it. This is not because we're being politically correct. It's not because of political correctness. It's because what we maintain metaphysically about the nature of mankind. You know what I'm saying? It's not an excessive politeness. It's not about politeness. It's basically based upon a core principle of we as Jews, how we look at the world. You know, there's a very big difference. One is how to be polite. Okay, so if you were in Victorian England, there was one way of being polite. And if you were in Japan, there's another way of being polite. And if you're in 1950, there's another way. So those are sociologically ever-changing patterns of behavior. Here we're talking about, this is what Judaism is saying about what the uniqueness of mankind. Therefore, being racist is really a denial of that. You know what I'm saying? There's a politeness versus a philosophy of life. Those are not to say, I want to understand those are dramatically different things. Okay? I want to now finish off with our last thing because we're at our last 2 minute warning. Okay. 14, how is MLK's dream not to be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character and expression of Kedusha? How about somebody in Zoom? I haven't heard anybody in Zoom. Take a film, Zoomies. Question 14.
I just don't feel, I mean, it's not, I feel, it's just not in line with, I don't know. Sorry, I just lost my thought.
Okay, no problem. Anybody?
Appreciating somebody for their inner beauty rather than their outer beauty, or their inner soul rather than their outer soul.
Right. Where does character come from? Or he didn't say that. He said character, the content of the character. Your character means your personality, your virtues, your values. Where is it coming from? That's a direct expression of your soul, that you are a compassionate person, a helpful person, a kind person, slow to get angry. These are all content of your character. So he's saying, I want to live in a world where my kids will be judged by their essentially their soul qualities, not by the fact that they happen to be black and discriminated against. Okay? So really, MLK's dream is the same world that is really an Abrahamic dream. I want to live in a world where people relate to people as a fellow soul, which happens to be associated with his body, and therefore treat people equally, kindly, fairly, and justly. Racism is just one violation of that. But that's the key point. And therefore, hinging upon that is therefore, and not to excessively relate people based upon their sexuality, which is what Abram in an extreme level did. You know, was extremely rigorous in that area. As Amanda pointed out, that's only Abram. Abram is a singularity, but it's just showing the idea, and it's more think for. So, put it all together. Abram, that Martin Luther King's "I Had a Dream" is based upon Abrahamic principles, which is based upon the biblical, the Chumash principle of Selam Elokim. And if person is essentially a soul, and therefore it has certain rights, and therefore Kedusha is relating to them to maximize their soul life versus their physical life, therefore MLK is advocating that he lives in America where people relate to people in a just way, which basically means as a fellow soul, essentially. So basically he was articulating the violation of Selam Elokim that was obvious and overt in 1964. Okay? And that's the basic idea. Okay, is that clear? Okay, I want to invite everybody. We're going to have a l'chaim for Amanda. Okay? We got engaged. We're upstairs. Okay, all in the conference room. Okay, so maybe I'll take the I'll take the Zoom with me.